Hello, my name is Sammy James, and I would like to welcome you to Boo-Ha-Ha Podcast. Here on Boo-Ha-Ha, we will have a different conversation every week on a horror or paranormal topic, and all of these conversations are with comedians like myself, who happen to also be horror or paranormal fans. We're going to talk about horror movies, horror books, but also some other stuff that might surprise you. And besides us all being comedians, this show also prioritizes voices that might not always be included in mainstream horror conversation. So a lot of these conversations are with people of color, trans people, queer people, disabled people, and the occasional straight and cis person as well. Anyway, I hope you enjoy the ride, and let's get going. Well, thanks for doing this. Welcome to Boo-Ha-Ha, or whatever we're called at this point.
I feel like this is optimistic that you still haven't picked a name after how many episodes?
No. We are called Boo-Ha-Ha, and you know what? Like, talking about it on the recordings takes away any plausible deniability, but a few episodes ago, someone told me there was already a podcast called Boo-Ha-Ha. Even though I googled it when I came up with the name, because I'm like, there's no way that's not a thing. I didn't find it. And I was like, oh, so we're good. And they're like, oh, so you're in season 4, huh? I'm like, what? No, this is
deeply confusing.
So,
that is so confusing.
So I will, honestly, I'm probably just gonna call it Boo-Ha-Ha, and if they want me to change it, they can yell at me.
I mean, listen,
they'll never find this. Theirs will be more successful, I'm sure.
Hey, don't be down on yourself. Unless there's an LLC, they have no legal right. I mean, if we're talking about popularity-wise, okay, but if you want to have a brawl in the street, just let me know. I have some chains in the closet. We'll make this a regular Anchorman.
Yeah, I am all set to change to calling it,
Oh, don't do that. You startled me.
Sorry. But anyway, here on Boo-Ha-Ha, yeah,
parentheses, question mark?
I have my guests introduce themselves. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Sarah Dietrich. I'm a New York comedy writer and comedian and a professional gamekeeper. I'm also a huge mess of a person. That is who you have on this show.
I'm two of those things.
Are both of them the mess?
I mean, it's one of them.
It's one of them.
It's like, I am not a professional gamekeeper.
It's a weird thing to fall into. It was all an accident, and here I am. Yeah. So that's fun. Yeah, I studied it in college for a major for a little bit, and then a minor. And now I don't make any games, but I do run games of Dungeons & Dragons and many other tabletops for a little bit of dough on the side.
Yeah, so first thing I've been asking on this is what was your intro to horror? And you know, I'm usually talking about horror movies, but since that's not really the topic today, can answer that however you like.
So the first time I guess I was ever truly scared at a intentionally scary moment, I should say, was during Lord of the Rings, the very first movie, when Bilbo shows the ring No. God damn it. Immediately. Take my nerd card. It's when Frodo shows the ring to Bilbo. They're in the Elven City. And Bilbo, like, freaks out in that one moment where his eyes bulge, R.I.P. Ian Holmes. And his hair stands on end. It was so scary that I used to get up and leave the room whenever I saw that was going to happen. I couldn't do it. There were many moments in Lord of the Rings, many gaps in my memory where I had to get up and leave because it got too scary. But I think the first horror movie I saw and I loved was the Italian horror movie Suspiria.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, yeah, a lot of people know the English remake, but if you haven't seen the original, it's so good, mm-hmm. It's so beautiful, and it's so scary and haunting. That's my favorite kind of horror, is the stuff that gets in your head and just kind of stays there and, like, lays over it, like a nice film on clear water.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I feel like that might be a good segue into the topic. Would you like to introduce the topic? Since you are clearly more expert at it than me?
I mean, listen, everyone's an expert at something. I just happen to really, really like tabletop games. So today we're going to talk about horror and tabletop games, specifically in Dungeons & Dragons. Just a really quick thing, when I say I GM or I GK, I'm going to try and keep using that. We're trying to fade the word master out of Dungeon Master. It has some really bad connotations. So whenever we refer to it, call it the keeper or the bookholder or however, we'll get it. It's not too bad. But I want to talk about Dungeons & Dragons and the monsters that inhabit them, because some of them are chef's kiss.
Yeah. Oh, so, it's just, I'm sorry. It's just like you saying that, you just started a thought in my head that, like, ooh, do I need to rewrite a big, like, popular joke of mine? No.
Up to you, but it's very much... I mean, D&D, Wizards of the Coast, just came out with the news that they are going back into the bones of this thing and rewriting it so that there's just not as many racial stereotypes. They're trying to make corrections because the people who made it weren't, you know, it was the 60s, the 80s. It was the 80s, it was the 60s. But I did a lot of research into Lovecraft, too. It wasn't even the 60s. Yeah. I am digging a hole of time. Yeah. But what I'm trying to say is the game is constantly changing because we as people constantly change.
Absolutely.
And games reflect our society and what we feel a lot in the same way that really good monster movies. Great things about D&D is that the monsters and the game itself reflects the changes in society because games reflect our mindset. It is a power fantasy. Who is the power really for? What do we think of when we think of power and things like that? And it's the same with monsters. Monsters reflect changes and fears of society. There's a study, probably debunked, that was in maybe 2006 or 2007, that said when Republicans are in political power in the government, the movies that are the most popular are zombie movies. And when the Democrats are in power, the movies that are most popular are vampire movies. Hmm. How we like and deal and fear monsters reflects definitely the time. And absolutely. There's some that are like forever. Mm-hmm. Forever fears, we call them.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of tabletop that are straight horror games. Call of Cthulhu is the Lovecraftian horror game. It's very theater of the mind. It's very scary. Mm-hmm. Vampire the Masquerade is another one that's very power-based, political, a little scary. And this is a smaller indie game called Bluebeard's Bride, which is a game just for non-cis men. And it is where you play as one of the facets of Bluebeard's wife, and you can play any of them. They have, like, the witchy part of her, the lover part of her, the naive part of her, and you all play together in a group, and you go through the doors of Bluebeard's house, his mansion, and unlock them, and it's all, when you open it, fears about womanhood or your identity just played out in front of you, because at the end of the day, the game, you cannot win the game. Bluebeard will always find you and kill you or drag you back. But it's about dealing with the horrors that we live in our lives as people who are not full of power and thriving. And it's a wonderful game. Big one where you have to use your safety tools before you play, but I highly recommend it. But we're talking about Dungeons & Dragons, which is, can, most often is not horror. It can be, definitely. Yep. But usually you know it as like the fantasy, you run off on your adventure, la-di-da, sword in hand kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But there are terrifying elements to this game.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's, you know, when you introduced this, I was actually kind of disappointed. I'm just like, yeah, I know, I'm not surprised, like, I know that's a thing. I'm kind of really disappointed that none of my D&D experiences have been very horror-influenced.
Well, it's hard, because at the end of the day, this isn't a game that was made for horror. The mechanics themselves don't lend themselves to a lot of strict horror. When you crawl through the house, you aren't powerless. But at the end of the day, Dungeons & Dragons is about, you have the power, you can fight back. You are never robbed of that power unless it is intentional and you get it back. You are the hero. Mm-hmm. And by putting you in the spot of a hero, it makes it incredibly hard to rob you of that power. But you can do specific moments and craft it carefully with everyone's agreement and slowly build. Mm-hmm. And some of the monsters that were made are specifically very, very scary. And I've used them in games, and I've had them used against me in games, and I have shit myself and watched other people shit themselves because these concepts are so powerful that they go beyond if we have power or not. They scare us. And it's up to the GM or GK, sorry, to build the moment right.
Yeah. I actually am working on a campaign for my other D&D group that I'm really trying to make it like horror influence. Like, I'm working on like a ghost ship sort of. And I'm just like, I'm going to do this, okay?
If you want to see a really good example of a ghost ship, if anyone is playing Saltmarsh, do not listen to this part. It's a big spoiler. Gonna give you a second. Are you leaving? Okay. In Ghosts of Saltmarsh, which is one of the published adventures, they have three options for different ships that you can fight. And one of them is a vampire ship. And it is exactly, I will send this to you, but it is, the way they build it is scary. It's horrifying. There's some that's like mindless zombies who exist on the boat. Horror on the high seas is rife with stuff. So scary. I think that's an excellent idea.
Yeah.
Very Obra Dinn.
Mm-hmm. And it started as, like, this is when, in case they didn't know by episode 6, they find out that both of us are huge nerds. In case they didn't know I was one.
Surprise, bitch.
It's like, but, like, so the whole thing is, I'm doing, like, the backstory of my favorite NPC. Mm-hmm. Who everyone who I've DM'd for loves.
Mm-hmm. We all got that one.
And but like luckily I also love him.
Thank God. Someone has to. It has to be you.
It's like, yeah, so, and I'm just like, you know, but he gets introduced as this just cheerful, very, you know, like level 12 gnome assassin. Like, to them, and I'm just like, no, we're starting, like, all the way back, and the shit he's been through.
Wow. So this is the horror aspect?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of just, so basically, his background is he was kidnapped by pirates, and then the ship crashed.
Right.
So, and he ends up on another ship.
Ship hopping, gotta love it. It's like house hunting, but different.
Yep.
Either way. It's interesting because you have a lot of great stuff written by Wizards of the Coast.
Mm-hmm.
And they put out great content. And then you have stuff that the fans make. And some of the fan stuff is incredible. I have a little surprise in my list of monsters that we're going to talk about that I have written down that I think people really like. If you've heard of this monster, you're probably a terrible person. But we'll get there. I feel like Dungeons & Dragons, especially because it uses a system of good versus evil, when you use horror and you start to find that gray area, the idea of moving beyond comprehension is really interesting because we're so used to these very binary choices that as we start to stray away from them, it makes for good tension building, and tension is amazing in horror. Yeah. Should we talk about some monsters now? Yeah,
absolutely.
Let's talk about some monsters. Let's get into it. So I'm going to start from the bottom, then get to where we are.
Is it okay if I ask about one? Because it's my favorite monster just in general. And it was very, like, it was very important. I've been kind of disappointed by not so much them in D&D, but the use of them in, like, games that I've been in that, like, I've just been wanting to be in a game and see a werewolf used well.
They're very interesting, and they're very clan-based, so it's very strange that a lot of people are just like, oh, the one is roaming over the countryside. There is a lot of political inherent power with them that I find really interesting. What did you have a question about the werewolves?
I just wanted to talk about werewolves. Sorry.
No, werewolves are great. I think it's because they're very weak, all things considered. By themselves, they are just wolves plus men or whatever. But there is like the old joke about the warehouse. There is the old warehouse joke that has been spreading over Reddit and other forums, where it's a group of adventurers who walk up to a warehouse and they were like, be careful, it could turn into a house at night. And the DM starts furiously erasing his notes to create Warehouse the Monster. It's very fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, the idea of transformation, especially in D&D, I feel like by having a world of magic, it inherently cuts the teeth of any transforming creature. It takes something that is scary to us because it's about animal instinct, and it makes it deeply understandable and solvable because the idea is it's a curse or it's a disease. But if you have restoration magic or wish spells, it's fine. You can fix it.
Yeah.
Some of the monsters that my favorites are, you cannot understand them.
Yeah.
They are so beyond. So I think that's why a lot of werewolves are a little disappointing compared to a lot of the movies, is because they're a little, pardon my joke, they're neutered. They're neutered in tabletops because of the idea of magic. It takes away a lot of...
Podcast episode over. No.
Oh, sorry. I'll go. I'll see myself out of my own house.
Okay, now you can talk about the monsters you prepared.
Thank you. My favorite monsters. So, let's start with... Okay, so I want to talk about my first monster, which is the Gibbering Mouther. All
right. I actually love these.
They're great, right? They are very scary in games. You don't know what to look for. Their mechanics, the way they are designed, is terrifying because it takes the choice away from the player.
Mm-hmm.
And choice in D&D is your main source of power. That is one of the only good ways to basically take the power away from your player and scare the crap out of them. So a Gibbering Mouther, they are basically large blobs that they're not big. They're around 3 to 7 feet tall. They're pretty hefty. They're basically these giant blobs that can be mistaken for earth or wherever you are. But they are only made up of eyes and mouths all over their body. And you know when they're the most powerful because they have the most eyes and mouths. When you are taken by a Gibbering Mouther, what they do is, if you get bitten by one, they begin to suck your energy out. If they suck your energy out, you die and you become part of the Mouther. So your eye and another eye and mouth is added to this body because it's yours. Mm-hmm. So if they have a lot of eyes and mouths, you know you're in for some trouble. They've been doing it for a while.
Yeah.
So the scary part about them is that they are this giant mass of just eyes and mouths, already creepy, but the way that they attack is that all of the mouths begin to talk at once and it distracts you. And as they do that, and it goes for a while, it's literally gibbering, and it will continue to talk and talk and talk, and you don't know what they're saying, or maybe you do, it's up to the keeper. But the important part is it slowly begins to rob you of your ability to fight. So if you want to use a reaction, which is basically if it moves by you and tries to like do something, you could attack it. You can't do that anymore, and it controls what you do. The creature can decide, well, not decide, the DM rolls a dice. Sorry, keeper. But it decides where you go, what you do, and how you do it, and who to. You are basically suddenly just a pawn in this thing's game. And it's very interesting because they are not that smart. They're just predatory. They're very scary. Like in the darkness in the house, you just hear the sound suddenly start to come out and you turn and this like what you thought was a lump of dirt moves in the shadows. And it's just chilling every time, especially when you can't hear anything but this sound. And D&D itself, like if you look up a picture of them, you're like, oh yeah. that's gross, but it's not scary. But that's the best part about Dungeons & Dragons or any tabletop game. You aren't looking at pictures. The thing that we love about monster movies and horror movies in general is that we never see the monster. And then when we do, it kind of robs us of that fear a little bit because we know what it is. Mm-hmm. Our brains are our worst enemy. So if you can't see it, and you won't in D&D because D&D is theater of the mind, then it's up to your brain to figure out what that looks like. And it's going to come up with the scariest thing possible for you. And that is why D&D is so freaking scary, because you come up with it. So that's the gibbering mouther. It's mm-hmm. very creepy. They were actually made of magic, so they're not natural. Mm-hmm. So it's not the scariest thing, but it's also man-made. Very Chimera-like, if anyone has ever seen Full Metal Alchemist. All right. Anything about the gibbering mouther? They're freaking scary.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't know what else to add or to ask.
They are so freaky. They are deeply scary, especially their picture. If you look and you go to the Forgotten Realms wiki, the picture they have is like there's mouths inside mouths, which is always scary to me. Teeth are weird. That's the gibbering mouther. Mm-hmm. So I want to move on to, we're going to go back in time a little bit to 3.5. So right now, the current edition of Dungeons & Dragons is 5, but 3.5 was what was sort of, we say it was before it because nobody really likes 4. But 3.5 was the other big one. It's very map heavy, very rules heavy. And 5 focuses more on characterization, which is to the benefit of the game and to accessibility. So, if we go back into 3.5. There we go. If we go back into 3.5, there's a monster that existed that is not in any of the 5 books that I can find. And it's called the Worm That Walks. It sounds terrifying because it is terrifying. The Worm That Walks is a creature that is just sentient worms. It is in the shape of a person. I can see, by the way, I can see Sammy looking all of us up as I talk.
So, Jesus!
Yeah, you just saw it.
Oh, God!
It is. If anyone really doesn't like worms or bugs, do not look this up. But yeah, you're good. That face. They're terrifying, right? You okay?
Yeah, no, I'm fine.
You scared yourself. So the worm that walks is.
And I knew it. I was just like, oh, don't do this. Why are you doing this?
You knew it would be a regretful mistake. It is. So the worms that walk are deeply intense. They are basically a new life form that's created when a very powerful and evil spellcaster dies. Once more, I want to reiterate, Dungeons & Dragons is a good versus evil system. There are shades in between. Mm-hmm. But in order to get the full idea of true evil across, usually it's a very strong dichotomy that we play with. And we only the players will dabble in the middle areas. The monsters will usually chill far out, except for one of them, who we will talk about. So, these monsters, this worm that walks, is made when a sorcerer dies, who has a very strong will to live and is very evil. A lot of people will think a lich is what happens. A lich is sort of like an undead magical mm-hmm. zombie, incredibly powerful, very scary in their own right. But I chose Worm That Walks instead of Lich because of what happens when they die. So basically what happens is I'm going to be a little gross for a second. When the body decays and worms come in and start to eat the flesh of the fat and things like that, the grave worms start to feed on the corruption as well as the memories and magical power of the spellcaster. So the spellcaster's soul is devoured, split apart into each of the individual worms in 1,000 fragments. And what happens is you get this disgusting hive mind of worms that thrive and exist. They cling to like this vague shape of a body, and they wield the same powers and death the spellcaster had. It has the same memories as the spellcaster, but it's also not an undead creature. It is a new thing. Undead, I'm not very scared by in general. Mm-hmm. This takes the cake because it's not undead. It is very much alive.
Yeah.
So I think what's really scary about it is, let's say you're a basic D&D party and one of your players killed his wife or his wife died. You know, they fridged the wife in the backstory. Whatever. I'm not bitter about old games and movies and books and television shows. Let your wife live. But let's say she was a spellcaster, hid that she was a spellcaster. And suddenly you see her form everywhere, the same cloak that she wore, the same way that she walked, but something was wrong and you can't put your finger on it. And you put your hand on her shoulder and she turns and she doesn't turn around. You feel something move where it shouldn't move. There's such a visceral disgust that it is many, many worms, literally in a trench coat, pretending to be a person. It's so scary. It's so gross. And it's like, it brings in the idea of death, of what happens when we die, of what eats our body. It plays on our very basic fears. They're the coolest. They are not in 5. I wish they were. There's some modifications that exist around the internet. I hope that they do put it back in 5, but we'll see. They're gross. Do you like it? Do you like the worm that walks?
I kind of do. Yeah, okay, I like God. I want to use this to terrorize some people in my other.
Right, it's scary. You're gonna learn some dangerous secrets from this. I could tell. But what they did do, the only thing comparable in 5 is the Great Old One, who mm-hmm. is the Cthulian god that you can make a pact with, you can be a cleric of, and there are some maggoty worm stuff that happens there. So if you like bugs and you're lazy, that's where you go. Warlock of the Great Old One. Okay, let's move on. Do you have any questions about the worm that walks?
No.
All right. Let's talk about one of the scariest and most recognizable creatures in D&D. And no, it's not a beholder. Beholders ain't shit compared to this. Beholders will bow down and worship at the feet of this. I feel like some people know what I'm talking about when I say the great dark creature of the deep, when I say an aboleth. Aboleths are terrifying. They are as close to ancient gods that we are ever going to get. So what an aboleth is, they're basically these fish-like amphibian kind of creatures. Huge, huge in size. They can reach about 20 feet across, and they weigh up to, like, the wiki says 6,500 pounds. They beefy. But that's not what's scary about them. What's scary about them is they're immortal. They can die, but they're very immortal, and they all have the memories of every other aboleth. They all share a wealth of knowledge amongst each other. They live forever, they are incredibly clever, incredibly devious, and their powers are mind control. So it's not just that they're scary sea creatures that would probably live in the Marianas Trench, but they are huge. They are incredible. So in order to survive, they enter this state of long dreaming, and they basically dream. And if anybody is really up on their Lovecraftian, very like Laaki, and you can feel the dreams of aboleths. They are the creatures of the deep, and they are so scary. They have minions. Sometimes you don't even know that they're minions. They live, and they have lived, and they will always live. They made the first civilizations on the world.
I like this one.
They're cool. They're really cool. People get scared a lot by them because they are so infinitely powerful that unless mm-hmm. you're a really high level, yeah. you're toast. You're done. If there is an aboleth even hinted at, the party will run if you know what you're doing. So if you need more of a description, we're back to the mouths. They do look like long sausagey things. They are huge again, huge mouths. They communicate via telepathy. Very, very, very scary.
Nice.
Yeah, and it's also, it's one of the, I think the higher level they are, the scarier it is. But what's harder is you have mechanics to deal with power, but you can you, the player, outsmart the Aboleth? These things are smart. They can play you, and there's not really any rules that you can make to escape from that. So it's a little unescapable, which I like. Yeah, I can tell by Sammy is grinning from ear to ear right now. So I know, I'm so sorry, Sammy's players. That's 100% going to be in the ghost ship campaign because they are water creatures.
Oh my god! I'm
so sorry for what I have wrought upon you.
They do. And they are going to end up in an undersea cave. Like, that's where it lives.
Oh my god. The Aboleth. Look it up. Look at you deeper into it. They are, no pun intended, they are wonderful. Yeah. Yeah. Dear Aboleths. There's one in the new Tomb of Horrors, which is interesting.
Yeah. And it's,
they're, yeah.
I've really done a disservice to monsters in D&D because a lot of my campaigns have been very humanoid enemy heavy. But I've been getting more and more into the beasts and everything.
We're actually, the deeper we get into this list, the harder we're gonna go at humanoid monsters and what that means. So that's actually a really good thing that you brought up, because in D&D, we have so many different kinds of races and species that the D&D guide itself classifies humanoids versus monstrosities or aberrations. Yeah. There's a strong divide. Like, animal handling won't work on a monster. There's a difference. They aren't creatures. They are monsters. They are aberrations. They are a specific thing unto its own. So when you move away from humanoids, which we can understand, to an aberration, or a monstrosity, the dynamic begins to shift because it becomes, just by definition, unrecognizable. We don't handle it in a normal way. It takes us out of the norm of what we deal with. A monster inherently is a differentiation from the normal. It forces us off of the comfortable track. So if you do human, 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 or humanoid, 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 and then you hit the monster, that's scary because some of these monsters have the ability to go deep. Which brings us to our next monster. If you really want to, if you really, 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 really hate your players, if you're a devious mind, you've heard of this. If you're a good, if you're a very kind soul DM, you probably haven't heard of this.
I am too nice.
You are, you might be, because if you've heard of this and you've used it, you are an asshole and I love you for it. Because I've used it. It is hard to use, but it's worth it. So what I'm about to introduce you to, if you have never heard of it, is a monster that was made by a player, that was made by someone who's not associated with Wizards of the Coast. So the person who made it, his name is Goblin Punch. He has a blog, so go look that up. It's a wonderful blog post that he writes about, and the monster that he created, or they created, I'm not so sure on the gender, is False Hydra.
I've heard of this.
You've heard legend of the False Hydra. It is very rare. It's very hard to use. So the False Hydra is incredibly creepy. How do I put this? So if you want the mind to be messed up, but also have a physical fear, the Aboleth is very easy. But there's also kind of a step back from fear when you see it. It's scary, but once you give it a physical presence, it's easier. The False Hydra doesn't work like that. Now, Sammy, when I say Hydra, do you kind of know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Forget about it.
Okay.
The False Hydra is not what you think. The False Hydra is a creature that feeds on people. They eat people.
Okay.
What happens is they start as a seedling in the ground, deep in the ground. They exist in the ground. They are placed in the ground upon their birth. And they begin to grow. And finally, their body reaches a certain size, but their neck keeps growing. And it grows. And it grows on this moist, damp, empty, hollowed-eyed, the teeth are large. Think it. But, like, it's scary. This bone-white creature. And the head begins to slowly rise until it breaks the crust of the earth, whether that's in, I'm going to quote Goblin Punch here, whether that's in someone's basement or on a cobblestone. And this awful face breaks free. And what it does is it begins to sing. And when it sings, it begins to change your memory. The singing allows it to slip in between your notice. It allows it to find the space in your memory and your attention where it no longer, you no longer see it. No one knows it's there. And it devours people. It drags people down to its hidey hole. And what it does after that is the scariest part and why it's the hardest creature to use. Because once it devours someone, and its head slowly comes back up to rest upon the earth and sing once more, no one remembers the person. No one remembers who they were. Their wife doesn't remember being married to them, doesn't know who they are. No one knows. Their house stands empty. It's always been empty. No one's ever lived there. And that's how the Hydra feeds.
It's like the freaking Weeping Angel shit.
It's very scary. But it's hard to use because you need to craft it very carefully. It's very hard to use off the cuff because you need to plan exactly what's missing, when's missing, all of that.
Mm-hmm.
If your players are being fed upon by a false Hydra, you need to have it planned. I saw a really good example on Reddit. I don't remember who wrote it. I'm so sorry, but what they did was genius. They had their party find journal entries from someone who thought that they were in their party, and slowly they realized they had all forgotten a dead party member. It's insane the way that you can use this, and it's scary because you can forget about it so easily. They're terrifying. And it's very fun because it's a mystery and you're like, oh, clearly someone's kidnapping people. But once you start getting into no one remembers them, that's different. And there's a really cool part of Goblin Punch's breakdown where you could do where there's a dissonance in your own mind where your body is trying to warn you what's going on when your mind is being raised or like it's stepping between the cracks of your memory. So you can wake up and you can see it's coming, it's here, it's coming for you, run, remember, scratch into your wall. And when you look down, your left hand is bleeding and there's wood under your nails. And you don't remember doing it. You don't know why you did it. It's very memento mori. It's very memento. Not Mari, whatever. And Mari. But that is the false Hydra.
It sounds like such a Doctor Who monster.
It's incredibly Doctor Who. They are very scary. The Sing especially is terrifying. And since it only has one head, you can cut it off, but another will grow back. They will grow back until you have many of these chattering, large white teeth heads with their empty eyes coming for you on their long necks that can move and retract. Very scary stuff. The False Hydra, baby. And I'm going to continue on deeper into mine territory because that's where Dungeons and Dragons gets you. You have a mechanic once again for everything but your mind. If you can trick your player, or not trick, but if you can build it in such a way that the player doesn't know what they don't remember, you've done it. That's scary. So we're going to move on to some other fun stuff. Or do you have anything to say about the False Hydra that you want to use it?
I feel bad because I'm, but it's, you know, I've been very aware that in my time as a, and you know, to use the correct term, you know, gamekeeper, that I've been a little too nice to people who play.
If someone pisses you off, you can build, it will be a long revenge, but False Hydra is a great way to get revenge.
Oh, you said the wrong thing. Because I'm just like, oh, I'm sorry, person whose name I'm not going to say. You know what you did.
Oh no, I feel we allow a lot of people. So I want to talk to you now about some more mind stuff, and I specifically want to talk to you about an Illithid, or a Mind Flayer.
Oh, yeah.
Mind Flayers, we all know them, we love them, we love them so much. They are, they were the oldest, because they are invented by Gary Gygax himself. Mind Flayers are a product of that man's mind. He was inspired by them because of another horror book called The Burrowers Beneath. He really liked the painting, the cover on the front, mm-hmm. so he made a Mind Flayer, which is like that it's like an octopusy creature with a body and these long, strange, tendrilled hands. They are very Cthulhu-y, which makes sense because Gary Gygax loved sci-fi and fantasy. He loved Lovecraft. He loved Howard. He loved all of them. So a lot of his stuff is very old school horror, which is Mind Flayer. They are smart. They are devious. And they are scary because, again, they are masterminds. They, in a lot of D&D campaigns, are often seen as sort of slavers, or they're seen as the people whose minds are behind everything, the bad mm-hmm. government, the this, the that, because their machinations go so deep. They are able to actually turn other creatures through a specific process to become like them. That specific process is called seramorphosis, which is kind of what happens to them, to be honest. They are born as tadpole-like creatures. They have the seramorphosis done to them. However, it's more powerful. It's known as an Illitherid, which means something in Undercommon, but I'm not going to go that deep. That'd be too much. But they transform into their full adult Mind Flayer bodies, and then they reach their final form, which is an Elder Brain, which is everyone's the Elder Brain. Very scary, basically godlike. So what they do is they are experimenters. They are scientists in the very darkest sense of the word. They like to transform creatures, implant their tadpoles into different races, which is gross. And the only way I could think of saying it, because that's what Forgotten Realms told me, and I didn't want to say it any other way. They basically only can make a new Mind Flayer if they use their tadpoles. But they are the result. They are the creators of so many bad results. Such as, we'll get to that in a second. I was about to segue into my next one, but I don't think we're ready.
Okay.
I mean, we have cranium rats and brain golems, intellect devourers, which are basically like little dogs that are brains, mm-hmm. Nerve swimmers, all that fun stuff. They also have their own society because they don't really travel alone. They carry their like mind enslaved people with them. They also basically have a ton of colonies and things like that. They're weird.
Yep.
I like them. Yeah, so if you have any bad political ideas, they're from the Mind Flayers, the Illithids. They're at fault. That brings us to the final and my personal favorite, that is a very new character, a very new monster. So this monster was created specifically for the new book, Mordenkainen's Tome of Foes. Mordenkainen's Tome of Foes. That has a lot of cool monsters in it. It details mm-hmm. the battle between demons and devils, which is always fascinating. But it also showed the birth of one of the scariest D&D monsters of all times. And the scariest D&D monster of all time is brand new, and it's called an Oblex. An Oblex was created when a member of the Make-A-Wish Project, as his wish, said he wanted to go and work with D&D people for a day. And he did. He went. His name is Nolan Whale. And he went and he showed them his idea for a monster. And his idea for a monster is maybe the scariest fucking thing I've ever heard in my life. It's called an Oblex. How do I describe an Oblex? An Oblex is what happens when a Mind Flayer decides to experiment on an ooze. Oozes are scary normally. They're very hard to kill. They're a little weird. They're splotchy and stuff. But an Oblex is a Mind Flayer infected ooze.
Jesus.
And they are a dark hybrid of both. So what an ooze does normally is they will absorb your body and they will slowly eat you as you are still alive inside their body. Scary. Yep. Not as scary as what this goddamn thing does. What?
I said I've used oozes.
Oh, they're very popular because they're scary and they're actually pretty easy to beat if you're a high enough level. But the Obelix is different because what it does is it doesn't just devour your body, it devours your mind. And much like a false Hydra, it takes your memories. That's why I put this last, because we're building to this moment where we finally get to the point where we have all of the damage and the scariness in one. This Obelix, it will eat you, it will take you. And what it does is it eats your memories one by one and then it recreates you. It creates an identical replica of you. And this identical replica has all of your memories. It has all of your mannerisms. But it can't really exist outside of the ooze. The main purpose of your copy is to lure your friends and family to be devoured by the ooze. You can tell it because it's never more than 2 to 3 feet away, I think, from the Obelix. And it's always attached by the stringy umbilical cord of ooze, this red cord. So you know it's there if you look hard enough. But it's really scary because if it's really well hidden, you don't know. The idea of memory, especially in Dungeons and Dragons, where all of the players take notes and they have to remember different things, when memory is messed with, it becomes terrifying because memory is what we need to rely on in our everyday lives. So when we start messing with people's memories or using their memories against them, we begin to fear this warped narrative that is our perception of reality correct, incorrect? We don't know. And the idea that what we are seeing isn't real or is different is so scary and is so mind-altering. That's why PTSD is such a hard thing to live with. It's why gaslighting is so traumatic. We live off of memories. Our currency is memories, and how we deal with the world is memories. What happens if we take memories or alter them? Our world changes, and never in a good way, because those are our experiences, and those are how we act. How do we act if we are not right? What do we do? What are the rules? We don't know. That's scary, and that is what is scary about these monsters.
Yeah. Wow.
Everyone go to therapy.
Yep.
That's my diatribe about memory and about monsters. I love them a lot. I think that everything, though, is silly, and I deeply urge you next time you play D&D, use one of these monsters, but also maybe use them in a way you didn't expect. Take a deep examination of what your power fantasy is versus the game's power fantasy. Figure out what will make your players happy. Figure out what will devastate them, and always make sure that you know exactly whose power fantasy it is, and the answer should always be your players and people who normally don't have power. Dungeons and Dragons, baby. Gary Gygax is rolling in his grave. Oh, you want to hear a weird Gary Gygax fact?
Sure.
He played so many games of D&D that his wife thought that he was cheating on her. He did that. That is true nerddom. That is true dedication to your craft. Wow. You play so much D&D that your wife thinks you're cheating on her. That's how much D&D do you have to play? How much do you have to play to make your spouse or your partner think that you're cheating? Is there a number attached to that?
Wow.
Crazy. That's a D&D monsterhood, and that's why they're scary.
Yeah. Is there anything else you'd like to talk about on the topic before we start getting into wrap-up territory?
Sure. I'd actually like to plug two things. If you really like horror, a really fun way to flip the script, especially because the way that women are portrayed, non-binary people are portrayed, anyone who's not a man is portrayed in D&D is often incredibly toxic. I had a friend who worked on this, Leon Brillo, and Leon and a group of very talented people made an anthology called Uncaged. in Uncaged, I believe there are two volumes out now that you can get I've on DM's them. Guild. They go into detail about how different creatures who are not men are portrayed, and you can do different little side quests or missions or whatever and deal with gender and actual interesting ways to see monsters like succubuses and things like that. Succubi, are they like plants? I don't know. But there are different ways to look at monsters other than what we've been taught, especially in D&D, where everything is unwritten and everything is permitted. So if you are going to make a monster in D&D, better flip that script or I'm going to haunt you. I will come back as an Oblex, and I will find you. If I hear you're pulling gender bullshit, I'll find you.
Absolutely.
And you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to take your body and use your voice to make the world a better place. That's what Mother Teresa would have done.
No, it doesn't.
No, she wouldn't.
No, trash. No, it isn't.
She's trash. She's a colonizer and she's trash. Yeah. Some other fun stuff you can look into if you're super dying to play a game, you don't know where. Hex & Co, they have, it's where I work sometimes, and you can basically sign up and play a game of D&D and learn the basics, learn the rules, so you can go off and play your own game. The D&D starter set is a really good place. If you don't have any access to that, you just really want to learn how to play. I actually learned how to play Dungeons & Dragons by doing some gamekeeping. I did it, and that's how I learned.
Yeah, that's...
Cast Party is also, they do free games right now, too. So I recommend all of these things and more.
Yeah. I've learned all of my Dungeons and Dragons kind of off the cuff, like on the, because like I started with a group and then that ended and the people who still wanted to do it were like, we need a DK, but none of us want to do it. You want to do it? Person who's been playing the shortest amount of time? Like, okay.
Okay. I think it's really interesting. I think there's two different ways to love the monsters in D&D. So, I really quick trigger warning, minor mention of assault. When I was playing my first game of D&D, my character was assaulted by the DM, and I was almost made to play it in real time. I wish I had left the table and I didn't, but it put a fire under my butt to learn how to play, so it never happens to anyone ever again. Because I'm going to be honest, a lot of people who listen to this, whoever listens to this, they're going to nod their heads because every time I say that, there are three other people who go, the same thing happened to me.
Yep.
It's so common. So again, whose power fantasy is this? And there's two ways to like these monsters. One of them is as a fun exercise. One of them is as a fun exercise where you get to see all this cool stuff monsters do and you get to use them and scare your players and it's fun. But the second part, the second group of people who love these monsters is because we relate to them.
Yeah.
We feel monstrous.
Mm-hmm.
And by God, I finally get to feel that power and being the monstrous part of me, then heck yeah. It's a weird sort of catharsis and therapy that comes with it that I'm not going to therapy for. Go to therapy. But playing monsters and being monsters is an incredible experience, especially if you've been through, you've survived certain things.
Yep.
It is therapeutic. It is incredible. Yep. It's your power fantasy, baby.
Yeah, and in fact, I think the first character I ever made was, like, very therapeutic for me.
Everyone does like... that. Well, usually people do that. I've known some people whose first times, they're, like, old veterans, and it's, like, crazy ideas.
Yeah, but just this, like... it was a human barbarian named Miss Jenda.
Jesus. I'm leaving. Get out of my house.
Okay, I guess I won't finish this. I mean, I was going to go into how, like, she had a trauma history that helped. My own, but okay. I mean, okay.
I got you. That's just such a powerful thing to play with. I've heard that from a lot of people, is that their first time playing as their trauma or playing with gender is through Dungeons and Dragons. And yeah. it's so telling about this game.
Yeah, and
about horror.
Yeah, and it's actually, like, that was the first time I played. My first experience, it was, like, some place where they had, like pickup games. And I was like, oh, I'll go do this. And, like, just my first interaction was seeing a gamekeeper who, and just, like, before I could even, like, get into it, like, had, like, a trans NPC who was clearly simply created to be shit on, and I'm like, oh, I'm not gonna, goodbye.
Just leave. Just, oh, that's terrible. I'm so sorry.
So, and then there was just like, oh, it took me a while to actually play after that. I was just like, yeah, I don't know.
It's a deeply personal thing. D&D, it can be more than just a game because we do reveal our deepest vulnerabilities, yeah. which does make it rife for horror and also rife for trauma.
Yeah.
If you aren't doing this, all my DMs listening, you should, or GKs, maybe. I'm having a very hard time. I've been saying the same word for years, but I will continue. Mm-hmm. I'm going to write it down. Yeah. GK.
Yeah, and I have already changed the wording of my Dungeons and Dragons BDSM joke.
I also had a Dungeons and Dragons BDSM joke.
Wait.
They're common. It's about my experience on Tinder.
But it's basically about how a lot of my friends are dungeon keepers, and a lot of my friends are dungeon keepers.
Oh, I like that. That's fun. Mine's a place of mistaken identity. Where they're like, ooh, so you're into bondage? What do you want to do to me? I'm like, I don't know. What's your intelligence? Roll for initiative. I don't know.
Yeah, but like, it's basically, so it's, the joke is I went to a BDSM event and then I went to a D&D event. So I hang out with two very different types of dungeon keeper.
I like that. It feels like when you say dungeon keeper in a BDSM.
I know.
It's like someone who cleans the room when everyone's done and puts the things back. That's what it sounds like.
But I think the joke still works.
It's fine. It's just something to be aware of. I actually, my boyfriend was telling me about how he ran a game and people were already uncomfortable with the idea of calling him master. Did call him dungeon daddy and he hated it. So you know what, fair trade, turnabout's fair play, you know.
Yep. I have two questions that I ask before we wrap up, but have you ever had a real paranormal experience?
Oh, baby, have I.
Thank God.
Oh, have I. So I get shit on a lot by my friends because I do believe in ghosts and I do believe in paranormal energy and stuff like
absolutely.
That. And, you know, I don't, I'm not a crystal person, but I'll tell you about ghosts. I'm very like ghosts. So my house, when I was growing up, it was sold to my parents by Linda Blair's mom. So the actress who played Linda Blair sold us our house. This was before I was born. When they moved in, there was a picture of a sea captain in the basement. Just, there was no frame. It was an oil painting. It was just stuck to the door. My basement is a murder basement for anyone who's never been to my house, which is all of you. It's a murder basement. It's like stones on the wall. Doors are dark. They creak. It is a traditional murder basement. There's random poles that don't even look like they're there for support, but you could chain someone up to them, 100%. It's very scary, very haunting, always afraid. But here's where the haunting comes into play. So my mom has this belief, and I'm not sure if she's wrong or not, that my grandfather's spirit is in our house. And every time she loses something, she says, 1 minute, I have to ask your grandfather. And she'll go away and she'll close her eyes and she'll open them again and just be like, he's guiding me. And she'll walk over and she'll find the object. She'll find it. She'll find what she lost. And she'll say, whenever the light flickers, it's your grandfather. The lights are new. They shouldn't flicker. I understand they do. I'm not crazy. Mm-hmm. But we had this. I just wanted to let you guys know because what happens. we have this painting that was, my parents, I guess, never removed it. They never bothered. It was this gray hair, older sea guy, the captain, had a pipe, all that. And every time we would go down there, it would just be there, and it would feel weird. And we never wanted to take it off. Like, every time we were upstairs, we would talk about taking it off. And then we go downstairs and look at it, and it's like we forgot why we were down there. We might have just been like 10 at the time. That could explain it. But I'm a very stubborn 10-year-old, and I remember everything, I guess. I think. One day, the painting disappears. It's gone. I asked my brother if he took it. He said no. I asked my mom, my dad. They say no. No one took it. No one removed it from this house. I did not remove it. And that's when my night terrors started. I've been getting night terrors now for years and years and years. They kind of stopped when I went to college, and then other things happened. And now they're trauma night terrors. But when I was living in my house, I always had the same night terror that someone was watching me from my wall, these painted eyes. And I would be halfway awake as I was ripping a poster down from the wall to throw it in the trash can. I could never explain it. It was always the same one. I have never had that same night terror since I lived in that house. They're different now. It's not, I saw a ghost, but I do believe there was a strange force that was in the house, and that when the painting vanished, either someone forgot to, the ghost got mad and took it out on me, because they always do. That's my spooky ghost story.
Awesome.
We still don't, my parents don't remember this painting, but my brother and I do. Very distinctly.
I'm glad that with these later episodes, people have actually had paranormal experiences.
I feel like if you're open to it, it'll happen.
Yeah.
Or you'll call something a paranormal experience because you want it to happen. I don't know.
And I'm very into all of it. I'm just like, but it's like the first like four episodes of this podcast, we get to this question, and it's always been like, no, but I'm in it. No, but I'm open to it. I'm just like,
that's not what I'm looking for. I need to say it real.
Yeah.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's my paranormal experience.
Okay. And second question, is there any horror movie, anything in the horror genre that you think is underrated or underappreciated or something that like people should check out that they might have missed?
I know this is dated, but if you haven't seen Midsommar, just go do it. It's not a traditional horror movie, but it made me feel good, in a very gross way. It made me feel really good. Ready or Not is also now on Hulu if you want to watch that.
Yep.
Great horror movie. Very fun, very funny, very anti-capitalist.
Yep.
Extremely good. In terms of horror stuff outside of movies and shows and things like that, if you haven't read the old horror classics, if you're mostly reading new stuff like Stephen King, take a dip back. Don't read, maybe skip some Lovecraft stuff because he's an extreme racist. Yeah. He's dead. He doesn't profit off of it, but he does have an estate and people who do. I actually looked up if the Lovecraft estate donates to any people of color or places that would help people of color. The answer is you can't find it. So don't give to his estate more than people have.
All right. Yeah.
But like Howard is really good. All the old, well, Howard is more sci-fi, but go back in time to Pulp. Pulp is outrated, overrated. No, underrated.
Yep.
I found it. We worked our way there. Try to think. Oh, if you're looking for a spooky board game, to play with your family, friends, it's on Steam as an online game. You can get it physically. It's my favorite game in the whole world. It's called Mysterium. One person plays as a ghost, and everyone else works together to solve their murder, but the ghost can't talk.
I've heard of this, and I've been wanting to get into it.
So good. You can buy a pack on Steam and I'll play together. It's excellent. If you really want to get thematic, what I do is I turn off all the lights, light all my candles, play spooky music, and we just rock it out from there. It is an excellent time. Highly recommend that game.
Nice.
For a really fun, another co-op game. So it's no one's against each other.
Cool.
Oh, and the ghost can't talk. You have to use art looking cards, like abstract cards, to try and give hints. Very difficult game. That's my horror game.
Nice.
If you like my voice and my stuff, you can find me at Sarah Dietrich on Twitter. I'm also part of the Boogie Manja sketch program called Boogie Manja. The sketch program. My team's name is Anxious at the Disco, spelled like the with the apostrophe. God, it's so hot. I can't talk. With the exclamation point after Anxious.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of our sketches up, and some of them are wild. If you want to see my beautiful face and me laughing, Pizza Party is a sketch I wrote. I was in the background for it, and you can watch me lose my mind at my own jokes. It is deeply unpleasant. But yeah, take a look.
Yeah.
Love me. Please love me. Please clap.
But thank you for plugging things before I ended by saying this is the time where you get to plug things.
I've listened to a lot of podcasts in my time on this earth. I know what's coming. Thank you so much for having me on. It's such a pleasure. We also, if this wasn't clear, Sammy is one of my players in another campaign.
Yes.
If this wasn't clear. So.
I agree.
Yes, you agree. You are one of my players. So you agree. All right, great. I'm sitting right next to a fresh pizza. I'm excited to eat it.
Yep.
Sammy, if you would like some, you're going to have to walk here. Everyone stay safe.
I'm in Central Jersey. I'm in Central Jersey.
You can walk here, walk on water. Be a Jesus type. Yeah.
But thank you so much for talking to me today. And. Thank you, everyone, for listening. We'll be back next time. Or will we?